and welcome to the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. My name is Reed O'Mara, and I'm the co-producer on the podcast. Today, we have a very special treat. We'll be talking about medievalists.net with Peter Konechny. For many of you, you might have visited medievalists.net before. They post news articles as well as sort of fun little informational pieces about the Middle Ages, from things like color in the Middle Ages, obsolete occupations from the Middle Ages, news-related articles like recent discoveries at archaeological sites or the discovery of Viking hordes, the history of medieval queens and gift-giving, this kind of thing. So it's quite the spread, and they're also involved with several podcasts and social media platforms. But first, I'd like to introduce my co-host for today's episode, Lauren Lee, our newest producer to the podcast. Lauren, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm thrilled to be here. So this is the first episode that I'll be appearing on. I guess my voice will be appearing on. I am a PhD candidate at the University of Virginia, and I'm the current chair of the Graduate Student Committee of the Medieval Academy of America, of course. I'm looking forward to helping to co-produce more episodes. So hello.
Yeah. Welcome, Lauren. Lauren's been helping us in the background all through season 3 of the podcast, but this is her first time on air. So we're really excited that she's joining today for this interview. Turning to our guest today, we're joined, as I said, by Peter Konechny. Peter, would you tell us a little bit about yourself and also about the work you do for medievalists.net?
Hi, everyone. Thanks. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Yes, I'm the owner and editor of medievalists.net and co-founded it back in 2008.
Yeah, welcome, welcome. So just to get us started, Peter, I'm wondering if you might give our listeners a little bit more information about what medievalists.net does and maybe a little bit about how it got started.
Yeah, so it's kind of like the idea was that it's the everything for anyone interested in the Middle Ages to be their first place to find it. But it has gone through a lot of iterations over the years. So before I even started medievalist.net, I was kind of active in the medieval studies online community. I had become the website editor for the Society for Medieval Military History back in 2001. So as a grad student, I decided I'm not going to do a PhD in medieval studies. I thought I'd better get a real job instead. But as I did that, I still wanted to stay in touch with the academic community. So I wind up creating this website and took it pretty far, I think, with putting out articles and online sources. During its time, it was quite new and groundbreaking. And so it kind of got me involved as kind of a medieval online expert. I had the idea that there should be some sort of website for anyone entering the Middle Ages, like, as you know, wanting to learn about it. You know, where do they begin? Like just a giant website. And when I was thinking about that, there were others that were kind of trying to fill that space, but they failed in part because they were very academic. They were from academics and they weren't getting credit for it. So it kind of failed on that end, which was kind of sad to see. So like I said, if I'm going to do this, I better make it a business. I better make it something that, you know, it's not going to give me credit in the academia world. It better pay me something. So I wind up thinking of it that way, as this kind of online, you know, portal. And at the beginning, it was very, very much an aggregator of like, hey, here are articles that exist elsewhere. And way back when, in say 2008, 2009, it was difficult to find online articles. So we became that kind of service, and we've changed it up over the years. At this stage, we pretty much produce our own content, but if we do any kind of aggregations, we'll put like YouTube videos of medieval academic conferences on our site and link to that. These days, it's mostly producing our own pieces, and I have a bunch of writers that do that, and creating news and creating podcasts. We have a couple of podcasts and every kind of social media channel too.
Definitely. I mean, like, it sounds like you and the team, they meet a couple different needs that might, you know, exist out there for people who are interested in the Middle Ages, whether that's just dipping their toe in and wanting to learn a little bit more about a niche subject that you guys might publish on, or again, I think this other resource you provide is just this aggregation of resources, essentially, of articles that, you know, as a journal goes defunct, where can this be accessed and that kind of thing. So this is really great. I think on the topic of just, you know, aggregating resources versus publishing articles, you might speak a little bit more about the kinds of things that you're particularly drawn to highlighting on this platform and how maybe this platform is good at like nuancing the Middle Ages by providing expertise where it's very easy to Google things about the Middle Ages and come across misinformation these days. But this is a site where you have real medievalists, as it were, publishing responsible information on the Middle Ages.
Yeah, so I always came to the idea that, you know, we have to provide something a little bit more extra than what's out there already. Because if you wanted to find like news about the Middle Ages, about an archaeological find, that's really easy to do. And there are many other kind of competitors, and they can be very weird, where like Popular Mechanics is a competitor with me about medieval studies articles. But, you know, what I kind of try and do is provide a bit more details that like an academic might appreciate, you know, a little bit of more information. Like I'll actually read the articles that this research is based on. So I have that, and I'll also offer these links to the kind of wider stuff that even if I can't cover it, I'll have some sort of material so people can search for it. When they go into our stuff, they can find a little bit more information and hopefully get to the actual scholars that are producing this work. So like I always try and make sure that every time I mention a historian, that I'll link at least to their academia edu page or their university profile or their social media accounts. So it's interesting how it kind of develops on that.
It almost sounds like a third space in some ways, but connecting, you know, academic articles and academics to this wider public. Lauren, did you want to jump in here?
Yeah, sure. I was thinking a bit about the way that medievalist.net can in some ways function as another avenue for preserving and sustaining medieval research. I think you've mentioned before that sometimes you'll bring in articles that maybe have been published in other journals, but then say that journal falls through, it goes under, and then the articles that were originally part of that journal disappear, but now they live on medievalist.net. Is that a happy accident, or is that something that you care about providing on medievalist.net, this sort of like preservation of research, having another space for it to continue to exist?
Yeah, like I am a librarian by trade, so I have that in me of like preserving every bit of knowledge. We do get, you know, a message every couple of weeks saying, hey, there's an article that existed once, can you help me find it? Or it was on medievalist.net once. And I'm pretty good at tracking that kind of stuff down. So there are many occasions where there's something on medievalist.net and the original place is gone, but I'll know how to retrieve the material and replace it onto the web. I'm always sad that many journals disappear after a while. I saw that a lot in mid-2000s. So you want to keep that material, even if it's not necessarily correct, right? So because we get, you know, all sorts of articles debating on one side or the other, and you want to see that kind of debate going on, and that kind of change as, you know, historians uncover new evidence. So it's important for me to kind of play that role.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I really like how you've just brought up this idea of it's important to preserve even articles or work that has later been maybe disproven or has been debated heavily in other contexts, so that we have that context of the conversation that's been going on. And that brings me, this is a bit lighter, but I'm sure that there have been detractors from medievalist.net. I was just wondering how it is maybe that you handle the haters. How do you handle people who maybe, I don't know, have anything negative to say about this, the function of medievalist.net, or about the content that they find on it?
Well, in my early days, it was real trouble for me, actually, personally. There were always like people, like groups of scholars that didn't like what we did. And I think they didn't like the idea that we're making money off of them. Right. I remember that they would try and come after us in various ways. And there was a couple of times where, you know, things blew up online, and it really did bother me. Like, we're like, you know, like your sleepless nights, right, kind of stuff. And you're just on super edge for a few weeks. But gradually I kind of got to know that, you know, most medievalists were pretty happy with what the work we were doing, and they kind of supported us. And they said, like, you know, if people hate you, that means at least they care about you, right? So, and I think I've developed a much kind of thicker skin these days to this kind of stuff. I just kind of ignore it now. But we take a liberal left-wing kind of view. We're Canadian. Like, I'm a Canadian, so you're generally a little more left of center. So when we put a piece on LGBT or Islamic history and stuff like that, kind of some communities will be very upset about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, such as I think is the nature of being a public forum or platform and being online these days. But aside from perhaps some negative responses from academics or from people who maybe, you know, you're not going to win them to your side anyway because you're showing these more diverse histories of the Middle Ages, I am curious what positive responses you've had. Like, have you had particular pieces or articles that seem to have really resonated with people?
I guess we always have kind of stuff that resonates with a larger crowd. Like, I think something went really recently is this. We did a piece about Nubian clothing that was reconstructed by a group of researchers. So basically, they looked at wall paintings from this cathedral that's along the Egyptian-Sudan border. And very typical with us, like, you know, I got the information from a press release, right? Which basically anybody else can access too. But what baffles me was that nobody actually else reported about this, you know? And so I wound up doing a piece, which actually didn't do particularly well, but I kind of decided I better put it on social media as the pictures, because I thought these pictures were so awesome. They basically, you can see this, the costume, this dress that a royalty or a clergy from the Nubian 10th or 12th century wore, and they recreated it. It looks wonderful. So, you know, posted that up as either photos or a video form, and it really took off, especially on TikTok. You know, it has 47,000 views on TikTok, that little piece. And I'm delighted. So, yeah. So we get that kind of occasional piece that does, you know, really good in one form or another, like in social media. And I guess I appreciate most when, like, scholars, historians, typically like grad students will come up and say, you know, I got into medieval studies because I was reading medievalist.net as a high schooler or my early undergraduate days. And it really led me on to this, like, wow, you know, that's a lot of high praise, you know, like someone like, hey, I'm doing graduate work because of medievalist.net in a way. So that's important to me.
That's great to hear. Honestly, I love hearing stories about how people came to study the Middle Ages and got this interest in it. So the fact that you're contributing to this web space and TikTok and things that are really accessible, and that's often how people find these things, and then they go, oh, I want to know a little bit more about that, and then maybe they go to the website, then there are links and, you know, scholars' names. It's really great, and it continues the field in some ways.
Yeah, like, people love to explore, and if that catches their interest in the Middle Ages, you know, that's great. Like, you know, I think I got my interest through, like, video games, right?
And
like,
yeah,
playing that and said, oh, I want to learn the history behind it, and like, oh, this is really fun. You just keep on going and going, and all of a sudden you're doing grad work.
Yeah, no, I think that this is such a valid and common entry to medieval studies, actually, is just video games and fantasy novels and movies and television shows. Like, we are so inundated with the Middle Ages, and it just takes somebody being like, wait, I kind of want to know how accurate this is, or I want to know a little bit more information about it. And using social media to respond to that interest, I think, is really great.
You were describing how you put stories out and you put content out in different formats. So it could be a TikTok post, it could be an article, it could be one of the podcast episodes that you have. Do you ever feel like certain stories that you put out are just better suited to these other formats? I think, like, for example, one of your successful articles was medieval pet names. And I just feel like medieval pet names might be harder to reach people or to really explore with the lighthearted tone that maybe it merits if you were to put it in a more academic article. And so maybe it's this format that it's better suited for. Do you feel like maybe the content itself drives the format that it needs? You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, I think, you know, the first most important thing is what's the visual component of the content, right? And so a lot of things that do really well, it's just because of the visual part of it. But in some cases, like, there's, like, the pet names, that's really just text, right? Like, I can put, like, a manuscript image of a cat or a dog, and that will help in some ways. But it's really people are kind of really find that, like, this aspect really interesting or neat because it lines up with whatever they're doing right now or they're thinking about. So those are the ways, you know, like when you kind of think of a content creation, it's right, you know, how does it work visually? How does it work as a text? You know, how will it engage? I think I spend more time thinking about the title and opening two sentences of an article than the actual article.
Could you tell us a bit more about what goes into, like, the sort of schedule? I imagine you guys must have a really tight turnaround for this sort of content. So walk us through, how long does it take to get this sort of material out there?
So we try and put out daily content, actually more than one or two pieces a day of material. But this typical week, running from Monday afternoon to like Sunday night, we have three pieces by authors for me. Plus, I've got my own pieces. Plus, we'll have two episodes of the podcast. We have the Medieval Podcast with Danielle Sobolski. We also have Bow and Blade, Michael Livingston, Kelly DeVries. Plus, I've done five book reviews. And I don't really do in-depth reviews, but like I approach as a librarian and say, hey, this is what the book is about. This is the audience it's for. So we also do a little video with that we put up on Instagram or TikTok or YouTube. So that content goes out every day. Plus, we've been doing Christmas cards through Redbubble, you know, medieval style Christmas cards right now, which is a lot of fun to create, and it's courses as well. So a couple of years ago, I kind of started up an idea, and I have a partner with this, creating online courses that are taught by medieval academics, and these can be live classes. In fact, there was one class just was running. It's like a 2-hour course on monsters. So we've got online courses that are happening right now, but most will be starting in January or February. And so we have got like things like that going. I'm also doing my own kind of online course. This is going to be on a second crusade. I've done the first crusade. Second crusade is going to be a lot smaller because not as much happens. So I'm going to put it out at a much cheaper price. But like the idea is, all right, I'm going to do all the crusades. And what I do is like these, again, as a librarian, here are the sources, here are the studies. Here's the information. You go off and learn about it. So that has to be ready. Plus, we got to monitor the Patreon and all the social media channels. Thankfully, I have a little bit of help with these things. Like I said, I have a writer. I have a person that helps me with my social media, things like that. I have a big team. And a lot of it is just emailing people and then making sure these posts get done. And that's just this week. And it's a normal week. And then, like, next week, I'll have everything be brand new with more stuff, right? So
I wonder, too, though, if having such a productive, quick turnaround, is there some sort of, like, satisfaction about that? Because personally, as someone who's currently dissertating, it can be very, emotionally heavy to be working on one singular project for even years at a time. And so do you feel like there's a sort of satisfaction to being able to send stuff off to the presses really quickly?
There is, but like I've gotten kind of used to it. Like this is just the tempo of being in the media, right? Like there has to be new material content going out. You kind of have to keep feeding the machine in that way. So I enjoy the fact, like if I do something that I really enjoy writing about, you know, that is satisfying. And like even if I write an article from kind of scratch, right? Like, you know, I don't expect me to spend more than 20 hours on it. Like that's all the time I can kind of commit to write 1,000 words, right? So, and like, it's extra special if it does well. Like if there's a lot of people that enjoy it and read it, you know, it's a lot better. But I know if I do that, like I still need something to go out the next day. So I guess so. Like it's enjoyable. Like it's fun in a way. But if it has a certain amount of stress to it.
This is the life of a or the week of a medievalist influencer, I suppose. This is all really great. And I think that I want to circle back and transition to talking about the question of labor and maybe creative labor that goes with working and founding essentially medievalist.net and figuring out how you're going to pay for it, as it were. So I'm wondering if you might talk a little bit about, yeah, I guess like the funding structure for this and how that might shape things one way or another, and how you make sure that you and your team, you know, are compensated for this work.
Yeah. So like we really are a business. We don't get any grants or any kind of funding from any organization. So the main way is through advertising. And I try and make sure it's not too obtrusive. So, you know, there's some people say, oh, your site's filled with ads. And like, well, I don't have pop-ups. So we have that kind of advertising component. And if we have a viral post, that really helps us out. Plus, you know, we'll have affiliate links like Amazon, you know, so we sell quite a lot of books through Amazon, but the percentage you get is pretty small, like 2 to 4% of the sale. But we also have ways of people to support us directly. We call it Patreon. So we have several hundred people that are now kind of, you know, paying between $1 and $50 a month to get access to our materials. And I think most of them just do it as a thank you for the kind of work we're doing. We're trying various ways of just trying to figure out, hey, will this offer you something interesting and or fun? And yeah, we can sell it. But yeah, it's a difficult task because it's always ups and downs. I've had really great months and I've had really terrible months. And the terrible months, you still have to pay your staff, right? I still have to pay my podcasters and writers and myself, you know, so it's a challenge, right? It's a monthly challenge. And then, you know, it's probably not something I'm going to do for like forever because it can be stressful.
I do feel, you know, it's an interesting parallel sometimes, or, you know, the nature of academic work in some ways and the instability. But part of the reason I ask this is I think that it's really interesting to hear this side of it. We don't often get to talk about these kinds of things, you know, about compensation outside of, say, the general sort of academic grant process. But part of the reason I'm interested in this is because you've had to develop a lot of different kinds of skills to do medievalist.net, right? You've had to figure out making a website. Okay, how do we monetize this? What various things go into that? How do I pay for my staff? How do I create content that is going to get views, that's going to be seen, and also be, you know, responsible and informative? So I am curious if you could just talk about some of these skills that maybe you acquired outside of your academic and library training, but that you've certainly honed over time.
It's a long process of like learning new things. So I started like doing online stuff like in my mid 20s, and you know, I'm now 50, so it seems I still have to learn this and that. But yeah, I've always thought it's important to always be learning new skills, you know, trying to figure out things like keeping on tab with social media. You know, a lot of things I don't do great, like I do it pretty poorly. So, but even these days, like I now buy the ChatGPT assistant. So like a professional version, it helps me quite a lot. And like, all right, I'm going to have to kind of learn this, A, because I know my competitors are doing it too. And, you know, if I want to keep up, I have to keep up with learning this kind of stuff. And it's fun too, right? Like you explore this new thing and see what it can give you. But at the same time, it can be daunting. Like you're always learning new skills that may not last for like more than a couple of years. Right? I've now kind of known that like everything moves along at its own quick pace.
You've just mentioned AI, and I'm wondering if we could touch a little bit more on that and how you use it. I think it's more and more something that's being talked about, you know, not just in medieval studies, but in all manner, honestly, everywhere. It's really like the topic right now is just how is it useful? Who's using it? Like what are the ways that it can be used responsibly? So I would love to hear more on your takes about AI and ChatGPT.
Yeah, like, you know, so it's funny because like a year ago, I kind of looked at ChatGPT and, oh, it won't offer me anything, right? It will be kind of useless garbage it puts out too. But it's getting better and better. So I'll have it, you know, first of all, I'll have it read all my kind of writing and tell me what I'm getting wrong in terms of grammar and spelling. So it's become this editor for me. I'll write something up and I'll tell it, make it better, the sentence. And usually it does, like it's a little more refined and fine-tuned. So I have it kind of doing that. I have it also, you know, say go into an article, like I'll read the article, but I'll also put it into the article and that and say, all right, summarize it for me, explain it to me. And then you can kind of take that information and like incorporate it into your news piece. It still has a lot of fine tuning in itself. It has its still flaws, but it's a really good assistant at this stage. And I'm still exploring. Like I just learned a little while ago to help me create images. So using that to make some Christmas cards. So it's kind of fun in doing that. But yeah, like you know, I don't want to like come across like, hey, you know, I'm making use of it unethically, right? Like I'm trying to use it as a tool, but not necessarily as like, hey, I'm going to create content purely off of AI, because I think you can. If you did it at like a lower level than what I do, it can be really easy, right? Like if you want to create like basic medieval content, it can tell you a story, but you know, I don't want to do that, but you know, like I can see that that's where people are going with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's important that people look out for these sorts of AI hallucinations, as I think people call them. But I totally agree with you. It does make for a really great assistant. And for anyone, I suppose, who's worried about AI suddenly replacing all writers or anything like that, that we're not remotely there. And the one way I've heard it phrased is that it can help you answer your questions and finish your sentences, but you have to ask the question. So I think that sounds like that's the work that you're still doing is asking the important questions and vetting information in a, you know, ethical way.
It's very much a conversation, right? Like that you're having with telling them, no, you got this wrong. Like, you know, all right, this is what I want. All right, make this title a little shorter, you know, or how am I like mumbling my phrases too much. Smooth it out for me. So it's fun to explore. Like it's very useful, and I don't know where it'll go, but the sky's the limit, it seems.
So you've mentioned how on medievalist.net you've pursued courses that people can buy. You've got podcasts. You've talked about these fun Christmas cards. But are there other formats that you're really interested in exploring that you haven't tried just yet? I mean, are there other directions that we can expect medievalist.net to go in the future?
Well, we're trying to publish books, so like old school, I guess. But like I've always had the idea that like you could take a lot of our articles and put it into a book form. The idea from that, like Danielle Sobolski, who does the medieval podcast, she created her own book, The 5-Minute Medievalist, which she marketed, sold herself, and it was kind of mostly based on articles she had written for us, and that really helped her on her publishing career. She's now in like her fifth book, and she's way, way bigger these days. So you can have that. Like, so I'm offering that because I think that's another way of recycling our content to a different audience. But I'd like to do more YouTube videos. I'd like to do more of everything, but you're always kind of limited by time. So
yeah, I guess on the topic of possibly going back into maybe what you've called old school, but you know, maybe it's medieval technology, the book, but going back to some of these other more, maybe what we'd call traditional modes of publication, but then also still going forward with like trying to do YouTube and TikTok and everything. I'm wondering what, if any, opportunities you would want to talk about for scholars, graduate students in particular, anything like that you want to highlight, just because that is a big base that listens to this podcast.
Look, if anyone comes to me with an idea of, hey, I want to do this and we can both make money off of it, like, and That can be as simple as writing for me, you know. But if you want to do something more, like you want to create like an ebook, or you want to create video, like I guess the question is like, what's it in for you, right? Like, what are you going to get out of it? Because I'm willing to help you out with it, especially if, you know, say it's a course, right? Like, if you want to teach a course and you have some expertise on it, I'd want you to do it. So the courses, you know, it's like, all right, create your course that you want to teach. I will try my best to sell it. And if we can get you a dozen people that will take the course, you know, that's great. And we'll make a little money. You'll make more money off of it. and we can do that. And my thinking on there was, you should have a venue to promote or talk about the history that's important to you, you know, to topics that are important to you. If we can kind of facilitate that, because we have such a big social media reach, because a lot of people visit the website, you know, that's what we can do. I also would say, like, I always give kind of lectures when we go to Kalamazoo or Leeds to say, hey, this is how you can do well online. Here's the kind of tools you need. Here's what to expect. If you want to create your own website or your own podcast, this is what's going to be involved in it. So, you know, we try and offer that kind of information too. I'm always open to anyone having an idea. And on my end is, you know, as long as it can help me pay my bills, you know, I'll support it and give it a go. Because if you gain something out of it, not necessarily monetarily, but, you know, if this is what you wanted to do, you know, let's help each other out.
It feels like it used to be that this sort of content creation outside of academia would not just, you know, not count towards tenure, but also be this sort of negative mark on your profile, as if you're engaging too much with the public and not enough with your academic peers. But do you see that tide turning a bit? So, I mean, it's not like someone could necessarily get credit towards their tenure or anything if they write a successful blog or start on a podcast or anything like that. But it is a way to build your scholarly profile and have people recognize your name. Do you see this attitude changing a bit towards making more public facing content?
Definitely. Yeah. That's like when I kind of started it out, like the reason I started it out is because I didn't think academics would want to do it, because it was like a death nail on their career. And it's like I said, like, well, I'm outside academia. I can actually do this. But these days you have plenty of people that will create their own podcasts, create their own website. Yeah. You know, you have this and it's valuable to you. So it's valuable for your careers. You know, that was certainly not the case in the early 2000s. But I think a lot of academics really see the value in that.
We certainly see the value in it, in this podcast. Exactly. I mean, yeah, I feel like this aligns with this podcast. I mean, it's not so much just about us and necessarily like our own, you know, academic careers, although of course I think that is another side of it, but it's that we want to make this platform for other people to share their research and get it out there, because the best medieval studies is the one that is getting to everyone. Like, I want anybody who's interested in the Middle Ages to know about it, right? We're all passionate. We love to share it. So I think it makes sense to have these platforms that share it with the wider public or publics.
I think it's also important that if you are a young scholar, or like not even necessarily a young scholar, but that you should be able to talk to the wider public. It's good for your career too, like, because I think we see that universities is getting harder and harder to be a scholar there, to get funding. The jobs are job market is tough. Like, the whole reason I became a librarian was I didn't think I'd have a job coming out of the PhD in medieval studies. Like, if I did that, that's great for 5-6 years. And then what will I do for a career? So I said, like, I'd rather be a librarian. And becoming this medievalist is kind of a happy accident for me. I didn't expect it would grow that much to be my career. So, but I think scholars have to kind of approach it that if they do a PhD, they'll most likely not become a professor at some school and have tenure. That's a very small minority that gets it. You know, you have to find ways of being able to show your craft. the most obvious one is writing books and articles. But can you make a living off of creating courses or creating online content? You know, I hope you can. Like, I think there's so many avenues. It's just, there's a lot of different skills you have to learn, and it is a challenge in itself.
I think that's certainly true. But I'm also thinking about of all, like, all the different Substacks I follow and that kind of thing. And that's a way to share research and also, you know, make a career out of it. But as we're approaching the end of time, I'm wondering if there's anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners about medievalist.net, about your journey into web and content creation.
Well, it's certainly been a fun ride. Like, I never expected kind of to reach the levels I am. I'd say I'm humbled by the idea that, like, I'm so well read, but also somewhat unknown in the world. Like, I rarely put my name to things. And I kind of, I did this kind of a natural shyness of mine to not do it. But I've probably been read, like, my own specific works, you know, 30 million times. So I know I have an important influence on the medieval studies world. And I try and do it responsibly. You know, I try and give a very balanced view of history. Like, you know, I will try and promote stuff about lands that are not typically talked about. You know, we're not just, you know, Crusades, Vikings, and English kings. So I hope I've made a difference in, like, expanding people's ideas of where the medieval world is, what are interesting topics. I hope people learn, you know, from what we've done and have this broader outlook. And like I said, it's a constant learning process for me, learning new technology and learning what people are studying in the medieval world. You know, every month there's dozens and dozens of new articles, and I get to, you know, read them or read these new books. Like, I get tons of books every week. So it's fun to kind of go through and review them and just kind of experience the joy of learning about the Middle Ages. So I get a lot of that out of it. And then if I can help other people do the same, that's even better, right? Like, you know, I'm so proud, say, of Danielle Cebulski, like, you know, how she's kind of gone from a person that was just kind of writing for me just as a little hobby to she has a career as a podcaster and author. And many of my writers have gone on to expand their world, expand their audience and platforms and stuff like that. And so it's pretty cool to see that happening.
I think this is a really beautiful note to end on. Although I will point out that you mentioned being shy and not having your name attached to things. I feel like that is so medieval. I just have to say it, you know, like, as somebody who works on art, I don't have any artist names, but, you know, we know the hand of so-and-so and so-and-so. So maybe this is the hand of medievalist.net unveiled for all our listeners.
I'm the anonymous chronicler. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Peter, for being on the podcast. It has been a pleasure to talk with you and get some insight and a little bit of background on a website I think many people who listen to this podcast, including myself, have visited. And certainly we've all learned a lot about medieval dog names as well. I feel like that post is everywhere. So thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This has been an episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 3 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, and Logan Quigley, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with new episodes.